From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On the Waterfront, the classic 1954 film about corruption and racketeering on the New York docks, is now out on DVD. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the film with director Elia Kazan, screenwriter Bud Schulberg, and actress Eva Marie Saint. Also, stories from a cut man. We hear from FX Tool. He started boxing in his late 40s and became a cut man, the corner man who stops the boxer's bleeding so he can fight another round. He made his literary debut last year at the age of 70. His collection of short stories, Rope Burns, is now out in paperback. And film critic John Powers reviews The Man Who Wasn't There by the Coen brothers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Investigators are checking on a new lead in the anthrax probe. Officials have found anthrax traces in the office mailbox of a New Jersey woman with skin anthrax. Another infection has also been confirmed in a New York Post worker. The New Jersey woman is the state's only anthrax patient who does not work at a post office, leaving investigators trying to determine exactly how she became infected. Health officials say they believe the bacteria found in her office did not become airborne. They say there's little risk to employees who might contract a more serious inhalation form of the disease. The accounting firm remained open today. The State Department has added 22 foreign terrorist groups to the list that faces tighter financial restrictions. NPR's Michelle Kellerman has details.
An executive order issued in September gave the U.S. government more authority to act against terrorist groups, individuals, and banks. The list first included groups connected to Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. Now State Department spokesman Richard Boucher says 22 others from the State Department's list of foreign terrorist organizations will also face tighter financial controls.
By putting them all under a single executive order, it means that they're all the terrorist organizations that we've designated are subject to the same set of regulations and can be handled in the same manner by the banking systems.
Boucher says the Bush administration's campaign against terrorism is still focused on al-Qaeda, but further financial restrictions against groups including Hezbollah and Hamas signals the campaign is widening. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Fistfights broke out between firefighters and police in New York today. The firefighters were protesting cutbacks in the number of people searching for remains at the site. New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani is defending the decision for the cutback. He says too many people are working in too small an area. About a dozen arrests were made. The Microsoft antitrust suit could be over. A federal judge must decide whether to accept an agreement worked out between the government and Microsoft. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Under the agreement, Microsoft will have to let competitors see the inner workings of the Windows operating system. The company will also have to let computer makers put whatever software they choose on the computer desktop. Charles James, the Justice Department's antitrust chief, says these measures will give other companies a chance to compete with Microsoft.
We think that the settlement promises significant benefits to consumers in that it will increase their choices in terms of the platform software products they're able to use in areas like instant messaging and others.
But many Microsoft competitors are furious and accuse the government of caving in. They're urging the state attorneys general to push for tougher sanctions or to continue the litigation on their own. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 59 points to 93.23. The Nasdaq was down fractionally. This is NPR. A white Cincinnati police officer has been acquitted of charges that he assaulted a black man who died in custody. Jurors deliberated for 2 hours before clearing Officer Patrick Caton of a misdemeanor assault charge in the death of Roger Owensby Jr. last November. Another officer charged in Owensby's death was acquitted of misdemeanor assault earlier this week, but jurors deadlocked on a felony charge of involuntary manslaughter. Caton's lawyer attributes the verdict to conflicting stories about what happened when police and Owensby struggled. Two centuries-old mainstays of American music are joining forces. Daryl Gray of member station WMUB reports.
Nashville-based Gibson Musical Instrument Company is taking over the financially strapped Baldwin Piano and Organ Company of Cincinnati. Baldwin, which filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy in May of this year, owes GE Capital $26 million. In the deal, Gibson, maker of the famed Gibson guitars, has agreed to take over GE Capital's option to buy Baldwin. Gibson, which started in the late 1800s, says it will move some Baldwin jobs to its Nashville headquarters while still maintaining a presence in Cincinnati, where the piano and organ company began in 1862. Currently, Gibson employs about 1,100 people and has sales nearing $200 million. Specific financial terms of the buyout have not been released. For NPR News, I'm Daryl Gray in Oxford, Ohio.
Authorities in western states are beefing up security at bridges. It's a response to warnings of a possible terrorist attack. Members of the National Guard and military were visible today on the Golden Gate Bridge. The Arizona Diamondbacks return home today following 3 one-run losses to New York. They're down 3-2 in the World Series. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross.
There's more to this than I thought, Charlie. I'm telling you, there's a lot more.
You don't mean that you're thinking of testifying against some people that we might know?
I don't know, Charlie. I mean, I'm telling you, I don't know, Charlie. That's what I want to talk to you about.
Listen, Terry, you know how much those piers are worth that we control through the local?
I know that.
All right, you think that Johnny's going to jeopardize the whole setup for one rubber-lipped ex-tanker
don't
who's walking on his heels? What the...
been better.
That's not the point.
I could have been a lot better,
Charlie. The point is we don't have much time.
I'm telling you, I haven't made up my mind
yet. Well, make up your mind before we get to 437 River Street.
On the Waterfront, the classic film about dockside corruption, has just come out on DVD. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from Bud Schulberg, who wrote the screenplay, and Eva Marie Saint, who starred in the film opposite Marlon Brando. First, we'll hear an interview with On the Waterfront's director, Elia Kazan. In On the Waterfront, Brando is Terry Malloy, a boxer-turned-dock worker who risks his life to testify against the mobsters who control his union. Some critics interpreted the movie as a rationalization for informing. Both Kazan and Schulberg named names to the House Un-American Activities Committee in the early 1950s. They both had been members of the Communist Party in the 30s. Kazan also directed A Streetcar Named Desire, East of Eden, Splendor in the Grass, and The Last Tycoon. He received an honorary Academy Award for his contributions to filmmaking in 1999. Terry spoke with Kazan in 1988.
I want to play another one of the most famous scenes in movie history. And this is the I Could Have Been a Contender scene. Now, in your book, you're very self-effacing about it. You say that you've been highly praised for the direction of the scene, but the truth is you didn't really direct it. It kind of directed itself. I don't truly believe that, so let's hear the scene, and then we'll talk about it.
I'll say one thing about it for you, dude.
Okay.
The scene is good for several reasons, but one reason is because it was beautifully written by Bud Schulberg. It's a perfectly written scene, and in a kind of a tough language that is poetic in itself, that's all.
And the scene is played by Marlon Brando and Rod Steiger.
Right.
Skunk, we got you for the manager. He brought you along too fast.
It wasn't him, Charlie. It was you. You remember that night in the garden? You came down my dressing room and said, kid, this ain't your night. We're going for the price on Wilson. You remember that? This ain't your night. My night, I could have taken Wilson apart. So what happens? He gets the title shot outdoors in a ballpark, and what do I get? A one-way ticket to Palookaville. You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum, which is what I am. Let's face it. It was you, Charlie.
There's a musicality in the way those two actors read their lines that is really something. Did you work with them on that?
No. I didn't direct that scene much. I didn't direct that scene, really. By that time in the shooting schedule, both Rod and Marlon knew what they had. And then the lines themselves are so beautifully written. Instead of a bum, which is what I am, that's the way those people talk. They're perfectly written lines, and Marlon naturally took to them.
You know, it's great. It's your classic talking head scene. It's two guys in a cab. In the back of, in the rear view window, there's actually Venetian blinds, so you can't even see the traffic coming through.
There isn't any.
Yeah, so it's just two guys talking.
If we had traffic, Terry, it would have been a distraction, wouldn't it? Don't you think so?
Yeah, no, I think you're right, because you're just totally focused on their faces and on what they're saying.
Right.
You have really taken pride in directing actors who are encouraged to ask questions about what they're doing.
Yes.
What kind of questions did Brando ask you about this role? Any questions?
Very, very little. I think we had an instinctive fraternity. I think we understood each other almost from the word go very well. And we would talk a lot about other things, but not a hell of a lot about the role. This role is written thoroughly. When he says, taking dives, Palookaville, all that, and it's written very thoroughly and beautifully. And he didn't need much instruction. I mean, I wasn't kidding in the book. I wasn't being falsely modest. I think I'm a damn good director and have been a damn good director. But in this scene, I didn't direct that scene much. Very little. I just put them there and so on.
A lot of the extras in On the Waterfront were actually longshoremen.
Right, and hoodlums.
And hoodlums, yeah. So you had a bodyguard in the making of the movie?
I had a bodyguard 6 feet behind me at all times. Well, there were some rough characters all around me, and they were taking offense that we showed Hoboken, for example, for a bad place, and they were offended. I laugh at that. But anyway, they had civic pride. That's what made me laugh. I thought they had civic pride, and nobody threatened me much. A fella came and slammed me against the wall and was going to beat me up, but then the bodyguard and another friend named Brownie came up, and that was the end of that threat.
Elia Kazan, recorded in 1988. Bud Schulberg won an Oscar in 1955 for his On the Waterfront screenplay. He also wrote the screenplays for The Harder They Fall and A Face in the Crowd. He first became known for his 1941 novel, What Makes Sammy Run, about a movie producer who ruthlessly pushes his way to the top. Terry spoke with Schulberg in 1990.
Now, you teamed up with Ilya Kazan to do On the Waterfront after you had both testified to the House Un-American Activities Committee. He said in his memoirs that he felt that there was a bond of understanding between the two of you because you'd both been through that. Did you feel that way?
Well, I felt our bond of understanding began when nobody in Hollywood would do On the Waterfront, when every major studio turned down On the Waterfront, which I think they should remember, and that Kazan's, when I was irritated about it, Kazan said to me, "Bud, I want to make this movie. If I have to take a handheld camera and go down on the docks myself, I'm going to make this movie." I think that's where the bond began. As for the testimony, although it is true that we were both what they call friendly witnesses before that committee, I really reject the theory that the ending of that picture or the fact that Terry Molloy testifies was related that closely to us. I spent about a year and a half on the waterfront. I really love the Rebel Longshoreman. I saw Father John Corydon go through hell, even with his superiors, and he was...
This is the priest that the Carl Malden character.
That's right.
Was
he was
on.
Really Father Barry was really Father Barry in the movie was patterned directly on this waterfront priest, and I saw Father John or Father Barry in the movie urging these men to get up and testify at the waterfront crime hearings. And I attended them every day. They went for about 5 or 6 weeks. And I spoke to Kazan about it, looking for the ending of our film. And I said, "Gadge, I think we have found the ending for our film, because these men are saying, 'My God, if I get up and do that, you know what's going to happen. I'll be in the North River.' That's what they call the Hudson River. I'll be gone. And that is what, that was the real source of the ending of that picture. It really was not the fact that we were saying, how can we get back at these people? I've had some disagreement with Kazan about that. He could say, and I'll make this very brief, that maybe that intensified his ability to direct that scene, or that it gave him some additional emotion, but I never thought of it in writing it, and I was the writer of it.
Bud Schulberg recorded in 1990. A DVD edition of On the Waterfront has just been released. Coming up after this short break, a conversation with Eva Marie Saint. This is Fresh Air. Eva Marie Saint won an Academy Award for her role as Edie in On the Waterfront. Saint's other best-known films are Alfred Hitchcock's comic thriller North by Northwest, John Frankenheimer's family drama All Fall Down, and Exodus, about the founding of Israel. On TV, she played Sybil Shepherd's mother in the series Moonlighting. When Terry spoke with Saint last year, she asked her how she got the part as the young virginal blonde in On the Waterfront.
I improvised with Marlon Brando, and it was an interesting improvisation because to this day, I don't know what he told Marlon, but he did tell me that I was at home and a young man was coming to visit my sister who was not at home, so my job was to keep him out of that house. Don't let him in the door. Well, I don't know what happened, but he went in the door, he came in the living room, we were dancing, we were laughing, I was crying, he was taking my skirt and whoosh, whipping it around, and the sparks flew, and Kazan saw that, and suddenly I was on the waterfront.
Were you used to improvising?
Oh, yes, I was from the Actor Studio. I'd been studying there, I was there about 7 years, and all total, and I had seen Marlon there, but I'd never worked with him. I actually worked with Lee Strasberg, and of course Kazan was there too.
Had you seen Brando in anything before starring with him?
Yes, I'd seen his movies, and I'm never in awe of another actor because it's all the same business. Some actors are fine actors, some not quite fine actors, good actors. I'm never in awe of anyone in our profession. I'm in awe of musicians or painters. But I was impressed, and he was adorable, and he was a prince, and he knew it was my first film. It was very cold in Hoboken.
That's where you shot it?
On the waterfront. In Hoboken, on the waterfront, right there. And it was very cold, and he was always giving me a jacket to put over my shoulders, and I was skiing at the time, so underneath my virginal navy blue dress, I had red long johns on. So when the morale was low, I threw up my dress and started doing the can-can for all the longshoremen.
That'd be very out of character for your character in the movie.
True. I'm glad. I don't think Kazan saw me because he liked everyone to stay in character.
Well, that's funny.
But that got a few laughs. But he was very, very kind, Marlon. We rehearsed constantly, which is what you do on a Kazan film.
Right. Now, in the movie, you have this, like, radiant, pure beauty, but in most of the scenes, you're wearing real schmatas. You're wearing this big drab woolen coat and a kerchief around your head. And
I still have that kerchief.
Do you really?
I always say, one, I should put it on eBay, right? No, sorry. I usually have one thing from each film, and I have it in a little cellophane bag with a photo of me and Marlon, and there I have the kerchief. I'm holding the kerchief.
You know, often in movies, you know, the beautiful young leading lady is quite glamorous, and you're so unglamorously dressed in this. Did it affect how you felt in the role to be wearing this, like, drab coat and the schmata on your head?
No, when I was making rounds in New York and the things that I played on live television were not very glamorous. I think you're thinking of North by Northwest. I wasn't really glamorous until mm-hmm. Hitch saw me as a sexy spy lady. And I remember saying to my husband, my God, he sees me as a sexy spy lady. And my husband said, well, so do I. So that made two of them. But the only thing is it was navy blue, and for some reason I never, ever wear navy blue. I think I was tired of that dress by the time it was over. Everything was navy. The dress was navy. The coat was navy. And in those days, we did wear those kerchiefs over our head on windy days and cold windy days in New York.
Mm-hmm.
In the 50s, we wore them. They were very practical, actually. So I didn't feel that I wasn't smartly dressed at all. That navy blue with a little collar was a pretty cute dress. I did feel embarrassed in the slip, I must say.
We'll get to that.
Oh, yeah.
Now, in this scene from On the Waterfront, you've decided not to see the Brando character anymore. But he's knocking on your door, and you're telling him to stay away. Then you lock the door and chain the door. He breaks into your apartment and finds you in bed wearing this white slip. Let's hear that scene.
Stay away from me. Come on, please open the door, please.
Stop it.
I want you to stay away from me.
I know what you want me to do, but I ain't gonna do it, so forget it.
I don't want you to do anything. You let your conscience tell you what to do.
Shut up about that conscience. That's all I've been hearing.
I never mentioned the word before. You just stay away from
Edie,
me.
Edie, you love me. I want you
didn't
to
didn't say I didn't love you. I said stay away from me.
I want you to say it to me.
Stay away from me.
And that silence and then the little squeaking is them kissing passionately after she's attempted in vain to fight him off and then gives in. It's really quite a moment in the film. I mean, you look like you're almost about to faint with being totally overcome by this physical feeling that's very new to you, being in his arms. Let's talk about that scene. How is that kiss staged?
How was the kiss staged? Well, we were struggling. We were struggling, and I was hitting his back, and I'm sure it was Kazan who said, just drop that arm at that point. And I did, to show
that you were giving in, that you were
kind of succumbing
to your feelings.
It. You know, when you just hear it, it's almost like two animals, isn't it? He was very, very strong in that. And she dropped her conscience, didn't she? He overcame her, and yet she had these strong feelings, and he broke through for both of them. She really did love him. I had trouble actually with that scene because I was in a slip, and in those days I was very modest, and I felt exposed. I'd never been in a slip on screen and on television. And the kiss and all of that, it was pretty physical. I remember just having trouble, and Kazan came up to me and he just whispered the name of my husband. He just said, Jeffrey. Well, I'm still married to Jeffrey. It's almost 50 years. And you know, it worked. I mean, that was it. I mean, another director might have struggled with whatever, but he just, one word, and no one heard it. Marlon didn't hear it. No one heard it, and that's how he worked. And somehow, I just knew that he knew I would relax because he had met my husband. If I thought of Jeffrey, and somehow when he whispered that, I just relaxed and enjoyed it.
There's a scene in this where he's been called downstairs by some of the guys who are out to kill him, and you've chased after him calling his name, and you find him in this narrow alley. And just as you find him and you're running down this alley to meet up with him, a big truck that's as wide as the alley is coming after him and therefore coming after you too. And there's no way you can be in the street without getting hit by this truck. So he breaks into a building and you both rush in, narrowly averting this truck. It's such a beautifully lit scene. You're kind of like in the headlights of the truck, illuminated by it, running for your lives. Were you aware of the lighting when that shot was being made?
You're never aware of the lighting, but it's interesting because when I did see it, it's almost like the hair has a halo.
Yeah,
as I remember, it was a very scary scene because it was wet. I had no idea that truck was going to be as close as it was in the scene. There was a place where we had to get out of the way, and Marlon was supposed to open the door. The door wouldn't open. He actually broke that glass. And he actually cut his hand a little bit. The designated door was not unlocked or was jammed or something. So Marlon Brando is that kind of actor. He just broke the glass and we got inside just in time.
I guess you didn't have to do that scene again.
No. No. Uh-uh.
You won an Oscar for your role in On the Waterfront. And I think 4 days after winning the Oscar, you gave birth to a son.
2 days.
2 days.
Better story, right? 2 days. Yeah.
So those are two big changes in your life happening just about simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, for most people, when they get the Academy Award, they want to be at their most glamorous. And you are at your absolute most pregnant. I'm not sure if you were even able to go to the award ceremony.
Oh, yes. I was sitting there with Jeffrey, and it was in New York. Now it's all in California, but at that time, the New York contingency and the Hollywood contingency, and there was a little jealousy between Hollywood and New York, so we really didn't think there was much of a chance for Waterfront, Black and White, made in New York. But we went, and we were all there, and some of the people started winning Oscars. And my dear husband said, "Now, honey, if they call your name, I want you to sit here and count to 10 and then go up." Well, I heard my name and I felt this hand on my thigh, pressing my thigh, and I'm smiling and smiling and I'm really counting to 10. And then I walked up. I didn't rush up. I walked up and accepted the Oscar and said something like, "I'm so excited. I may have the baby right here." And of course, I had it two days later.
Eva Marie Saint speaking with Terry Gross. A DVD edition of On the Waterfront has just been released. I'm Barbara Bulgave, and this is Fresh Air. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Thunder and Lightning, Cracking Open the Writer's Craft by Natalie Goldberg, author of Wild Mind. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Rope Burns, stories from the boxing ring. A talk with FX Tool. He was a boxer and then a cut man. Last year, at the age of 70, he made his literary debut with a collection of short stories. It's now out in paperback. And John Powers reviews the new Coen Brothers film, The Man Who Wasn't There.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. FX Toole learned to box when he was in his late 40s. It was too late to make it as a boxer, but he stayed in that world as a cut man. In between rounds, the cut man stops his boxer's bleeding so that he can get back in the ring. At the age of 70, Toole wrote a collection of short stories called Rope Burns. It's now out in paperback. The review in the LA Times described it as a book of chillingly authentic short stories about fighters and fighting, written from as far inside as you can get. Although Toole had a trunk full of novels, stories, and plays, this was his first published book. He didn't want his boxing friends to know that he was writing stories set in their world, so he used the pen name FX Toole. But the good reviews blew his cover. His real name is Jerry Boyd. Terry spoke with FX Toole last year. He started with a reading from the first story in Rope Burns about a cut man.
I stop blood. I stop it between rounds for fighters so they can stay in the fight. Blood ruins some boys. It was that way with Sonny Liston, God rest his soul. Bad as he was, he'd see his own blood and fall apart. I'm not the one who decides when to stop the fight, and I don't stitch up cuts once the fight's over. And it's not my job to hospitalize a boy for brain damage. My job is to stop blood so the fighter can see enough to keep on fighting. I do that, maybe I save a boy's title. I do that one thing, and I'm worth every cent they pay me. I stop the blood and save the fight. The boy loves me more than he loves his daddy. But you can't always stop it. Fight guys know this. If the cut's too deep or wide, or maybe you've got a severed vein down in there, the blood keeps coming. Sometimes it takes two or three rounds to stop the blood, maybe more. The boy's heart is pumping so hard, or he cuts more. Once you get the coagulant in there, sometimes it takes another shot from the opponent right on the cut itself to drive the blood far enough from the area so the stuff you're using can start to work. What I'm saying is there are all kinds of combinations you come up against down in the different layers of meat. When a good cut man stays ahead of the combinations, he can stop most cuts, but not everyone.
And that's FX Toole reading from his new collection of short stories, Rope Burns. Let's talk a little bit more about what you do as a cut man. What are some of the medicines that you have to stop bleeding?
Well, there's a lot of stuff that's illegal, but most of the time you're using, and I say most of the time, I'm generalizing, but you use adrenaline 1-1000. It's a topical a vasal constrictor, not the kind you inject. Then there's thrombin, which is a coagulant rather than a vasal constrictor. There's stuff called Atovine. Much of this stuff is used during surgery.
What's your training like to do this? Do you study medicine at all, or do you just study with another cutter?
You study with other guys. You pick their brains. You have to remember that what you're working on is a restricted area, and the tissue's not very deep. Okay, it's not as if you're trying to work on someone who's suffering a stab wound in the liver. It's shallow tissue. Sometimes it looks like during the fight. Sometimes you think you're looking down into a volcano, but it's that's obviously not the case. So you're working on the face primarily, the forehead, the scalp maybe. And so you learn how to stop that blood. You don't learn how to deal with stab wounds.
Tell me more about what goes on in the corner during the period between rounds. If the fighter is tired and he's bleeding, who's paying attention to him? What's everybody doing? Who's competing for his time there?
Well, what you do is you get him breathing deeply from the diaphragm, number one. And you water him down. You put ice packs on him, and you get him breathing, breathing, breathing. Now, if he's cut, you've got to do all of that and get the blood stopped at the same time. But the fighter is completely focused on you, and he trusts you. He's put his life in your hands, which is one of the reasons I'm so careful about what I do with these kids. And so he's focused on you, and he's learned through the whole training process to listen to you. While the crowd is roaring, he will hear your voice above them all if you shout instructions up to him. But now he's cut, and now he's tired. You get him breathing, you get him breathing, you get him breathing, you cool him down, and you'll be surprised how someone in good condition, and I'm speaking cardiovascular now, will revive in just that time. Now, if he's terribly hurt, I've called fights off, but that's the last resort. You don't want to do that because Again, his future is in your hand, in your hands, but you don't want to make a decision to make his future his past either.
As the cut man, it's your job to stop the blood when a boxer's bleeding, when your boxer's bleeding. And I'm wondering how the whole idea of bleeding has changed in the HIV era.
Well, you know, when the HIV really hit and AIDS was rampant and it first hit, got the publicity it did, 10 years or so ago, we were, we were instructed to wear gloves, rubber gloves. Fighters at that time and since have had to take AIDS tests. So at that time it was a much bigger problem than it is today. Now I don't even think they hand out rubber gloves anymore because there are the AIDS test comes along and it's yesterday, you follow, and so they know whether or not these guys are infected. There was a heck of a heavyweight here not too long ago whose test proved positive for AIDS. And here was a big monster of a guy. The odds are he got it using steroids because he was a tall, thin kid at one time. And 2 years later, he's a monster heavyweight.
How would you get AIDS by using steroids?
The needle.
Oh, I see. Got it.
So these guys might be in the gym and say, here, you use the needle, I'll use the needle, you use the needle.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. People often are quite foolish in terms of what they do.
Huh. You know the expression punch drunk, where somebody seems to have lost some of their senses, some of their capacity to think and speak because they've been knocked around too much.
Sure.
Do you see boxers who actually have that condition?
Sure. Yes. I work with one right now. Who talks like that? He talks to a known. And he walks with a limp, and you have to say, what? What did you say? What? Now, why did that happen? That happened because he was a great young fighter who never got into shape. He tells a great story. He says he prayed before every fight. He said, God, please let me get through this fight, and I promise next fight I'll be in shape. And he said, and I never got in shape. So he fought too long. He got hit too much. One of the reasons he's talking that way is because his nose is broken. It goes off at an angle. But indeed, there's an example. And you know what? He has no regrets whatsoever. He'll joke about the whole show.
In your book, you write, boxing is an unnatural act. Everything in boxing is backwards to life. Instead of running from pain, which is the natural thing in life, in boxing, you step to it. You've boxed as well as worked as a cut man. What's it like to try to get over those natural instincts and replace them with boxing instincts?
Well, I boxed, but you have to understand, my boxing began when I was 48, and I sparred in the gym. I worked out in the gym. I did what we call worked. And I didn't do it as long as I would have, but if you can imagine, I wear glasses, so when I was sparring, I was throwing punches at shadows, so I probably took more shots than I would have. What happens to you is you become focused on the idea of landing your shots to the other guy, of doing damage to your opponent. And so you take shots, and you have to understand that you're in what's called, Hemingway called hot blood. And so the shots don't hurt you as much while you're excited because adrenaline is part of the formula. It's later on that fighters, for a day or so afterwards, they'll be holding their ribs, or you'll see fighters wearing dark glasses for a couple days, that sort of thing.
I imagine it was a little harder for you to take blows or heal from wounds in your late 40s.
Oh, sure. And I had teeth cracked. I'd had my nose broken before, but I had it broken again. And I would have kept on boxing. I had to quit because I developed a jaw problem, and I was told that I had to wear braces. So you can't box and wear braces. So that's a regret that I have. But nonetheless, a necessary thing for me to have done. Along the way, I found that I was able to do this stuff. I was able to focus. I was able to remember the mechanics. First of all, do the mechanics. The mechanics free your mind. Now, How do you hit this other guy? In a street fight, you can rush up and grab someone by the shirt, by the throat, by the neck, by the head, trip him, knock him down, kick him, and all of that good stuff. But in the ring, it's very hard to hit an opponent who's not going to stand there and fight you back. If he just moves, you're probably not going to be able to do much more than tap him on the shoulder. So, I learned how to do all of this stuff, how to cut off the ring, how to throw punches correctly, how to protect myself. So, it became a way of life for me to the degree that I actually quit writing. I said, why am I ruining my life writing when I can do this other thing? I can participate in it every day instead of being an outsider, instead of being, someone howling in the woods for all those years. Writing became unimportant to me, and I said, forget it. I'm not gonna hurt like that anymore. So I know about hurt outside of the ring as well as inside of the ring.
You're talking about the hurt of rejection?
Absolutely. That would destroy me. It would just put me flat on my face.
That hurts more than the broken nose?
Oh, absolutely. No comparison. I'd take a broken nose any old day. To sit there, with that brown envelope in your lap and your head in your hands, and you say to yourself, who am I kidding? I'm no good. If I was any good, somebody would have bought this. I'm just kidding myself. I've wasted my life. I've thrown it away. I thought it was the muse who kissed me, who tapped me on the shoulder, and it was a whore that did. And I've been drained of all my resources. Here I am, a complete fool. Why am I doing this? I've just kidded myself. And I'd go through that, and then slowly, I'd get back to my feet. Suddenly, another story would play before my eyes, and I'd be back at it again.
FX Tool, speaking last year with Terry Gross. His collection of short stories, Rope Burns, is just out in paperback. We'll hear more after the break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Terry Gross's interview with FX Tool. His collection of short stories about life in the boxing ring, Rope Burns, is now out in paperback.
Now, I know as a young man, you studied acting with Sanford Meisner, the famous acting teacher at the Neighborhood Playhouse in New York.
Yes.
You had written plays that weren't produced, but you wrote them. Any connection between boxing and theater?
Oh, there's a lot of performance in boxing. In fact, when I see fight movies and they try to train fighters to perform like fighters, it usually doesn't work. Oftentimes, they don't take enough time because it takes a long time to learn how to do this stuff. So I would say that they probably should take fighters and train them to be actors. It would probably shorten the process. But indeed, there's a lot of showbiz in the game, and the audience is there to be entertained. You entertain them differently than in the theater, and yet the drama is there. It's real drama. It's going on right before their eyes.
Of course, in boxing, it's not stage blood. It's real blood.
It's the real deal.
And you like that?
Sure.
Why do you prefer real blood to stage blood?
Well, because it's real. You know, I was a bullfighter, and I was gored three times. And so for me to see blood pumping out is not that big a deal. I was gored in the bladder, I was gored in my left leg a couple of times. One of the times there were three trajectories that were as long as your hand. At the time, I weighed probably 140 pounds. I'm 6 foot tall, so you can imagine how thin my leg was. It's part of the territory. It's the price of doing business. It's being there at the time when the greatest challenge is met. And then it's also being there when that challenge is met in a positive or a negative way. And so, again, it's real drama. It's not playing. I can go home after the theater or go to the local bar and have a few pops and forget about it. This is stuff that you take for the rest of your life, with you for the rest of your life. And that's what I see life as, a series of experiences that should be lived, not nullified, not anesthetized with drugs, etc.
What about street fighting? Were you ever into that? I mean, it's not in an arena, but there's certainly a lot of theatrics and a lot of street fighting and a lot of posturing as well.
Well, I've been in a few street fights. When I was 49 or so, something like that, I was in a street fight, and I had part of my right ear bitten off, as a matter of fact. But my opponent was about to go blind, and the only thing that saved him was his girlfriend pulling me off of him. So street fights are nasty and ugly, and the goal is to do maximum damage in the minimum amount of time. So and you know you got your adversary down, and you want to make sure he cannot get up, and if he does get up, he's never going to want to come looking for you again. In boxing, winner loser, they go across the ring and they embrace and say good fight, and the loser says, well, he was a better man today. If he has talent and ability and one thing and another, that may well be the case. So he'll come back and fight another day. Street fights, you don't ordinarily fight the second or third or fourth or 20th time afterwards.
Who was the first person who read one of your stories and said, I'm going to publish this?
It was Howard Junker, God bless him, at a literary magazine out of San Francisco called Zizziva, and Z-Y-Z-Z-Y-V-A. And one day I got a phone call, and he introduced himself, and he said, this is a terrific story. I want to publish it. And I said, you're kidding. And he said, no, I want to do it. And we chatted a moment, and I think for the first time in my life, I used the word flabbergasted, because I've never used that word before, because I usually have plenty to say, right? But I just could not. I could not believe it. At that moment, I was vindicated, if you will. At that moment, I was a successful writer.
Had you sent him the story?
I had sent him the story through the mail, like I always have. I never put any blurb about myself. I just submit the story, and I was always very selfish about writing. If I was going to have any success in writing or be published at all, I wanted to be absolutely on the merit of the work, as read by someone anonymous, reading an anonymous writer. And that's what happened finally after 40 years.
You're somebody who, in a way, starts things or accomplishes things late in life. You know, you started boxing at the age of 48. You're about 70 now, is that right?
70, yeah.
Yeah, and your first book has just been published. This is something you've wanted your whole life. What's it like to get something that you've always wanted, but get it at the age of 70, when you're not looking ahead at your whole life any longer?
Well, it's sweet indeed. I will also tell you that if this had happened to me at 35, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation, because I was, let's say, something of a wild man. I would probably have destroyed myself along the way, because I'm hoping to make some money on this, but let's assume that I would have made some money. I would have probably squandered it and squandered everything else along with it, because I would have wanted to push the envelope on principle, but also in terms of understanding the world, and if nothing else, to have more things to write about. So it's probably the best thing that could have happened to me individually. I look around and I see so many young people who get success early on, fold in the stretch, if you will, and destroy themselves and destroy a lot of people around them. And what a great tragedy that is, because I think many of them end up with success that they don't feel they've earned. I've earned every bit of it. However much I get, I will have earned it. And I don't say that as some kind of a nut puffing myself up. I'm just saying I paid my dues. Here it is. Thank God it's here. And I'm going to protect it and nurture it to the best of my ability.
Have you saved all your earlier writing? And do you like some of that stuff?
Some of it I do. I will tell you, the first thing I really wrote seriously was a bullfight novel after I had been blown out of the game, and I returned to California, to Los Angeles. And I was working in the Good Humor ice cream factory, the swing shift. I was climbing down in the stainless steel vaults with vats with live steam. And go home at midnight, 1 a.m. My wife and baby were asleep. I was still charged up. And somewhere or another, I had the idea that I wanted to write a bullfight novel. So I did. And I still have it. It's wrapped up in the brown paper, you know, in the stamp that I sent it to myself. I think the date is February something in 1958. I'm terrified to open those pages to go back and read how terrible it must be. On the other hand, there's some great material in there, okay? And if I live long enough, maybe I can go back and use some of that.
Well, FX Tool, Jerry Boyd, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a great delight to be with you.
FX Tool's collection of short stories, Rope Burns, is out in paperback. This is Fresh Air. The Man Who Wasn't There is the new movie from Joel and Ethan Coen. Billy Bob Thornton stars along with Frances McDormand and two well-known TV actors, Michael Badalucco from The Practice and James Gandolfini from The Sopranos. John Powers has a review.
No filmmakers alive would seem to be more in love with film noir than Joel and Ethan Coen, who began their career with Blood Simple, a Texas update of James Caan, copied Dashiell Hammett in Miller's Crossing, and did a goofy riff on Raymond Chandler in The Big Lebowski. But while the Coens obviously adore film noir, they adore it like a husband who insists that his wife dress exactly the way he likes. They make everything fit their own sensibility, which is profoundly un-noirish. Cool, clever, totally under control. All those qualities are on display in The Man Who Wasn't There, a drifty new crime story set in a small California town in 1949. Billy Bob Thornton stars as the story's taciturn narrator, Ed Crane. Ed works unhappily as the second barber in a shop owned by his yakety brother-in-law, played by Michael Badalucco. Ed's unenthusiastically married to Doris, that's Frances McDormand, who he suspects is carrying on with her boss, Big Dave, who's played by James Gandolfini. In hopes of a new life, Ed decides to blackmail Big Dave for $10,000 and invest it in a dry cleaning operation run by a shifty, toupeed huckster. Naturally, his plans go awry, unleashing murder and suicide and legal insanity. Ed finds his only solace in a teenage girl, Bertie Abundis, who he overhears practicing Beethoven on the piano. Played by Scarlett Johansson, Bertie becomes a beacon of purity, a possible source of escape from the small-town hell that Ed at least partly created for himself. Here, he tells her about his plans for her music career.
There's this guy in San Francisco. I've made inquiries. Everybody says he's the best. Trained people who've gone on to big concert careers and symphony orchestras, the works. His name is Jacques Carcinogus. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. Anyway, Frenchman.
Oh, boy, Frenchman, huh?
You've got talent. Anybody can see that. And he's the best. If he sees a student that he thinks has talent, he takes him on for next to nothing. So you're a cinch to be accepted. I could cover the cost of the lessons. Like I said, it's pretty modest.
Oh, geez, Mr. Crane.
No, I have to do it. I can't stand by and watch any more things go down the drain. You're young. You don't understand.
Well, geez, Mr. Crane, I hadn't really thought about it. A career stuff.
Well, I know you haven't. Look, just go see him as a favor to me. I talked to this guy. He loosened up a little bit when I told him how talented you are. He's agreed to see you this Saturday. He said, maybe you're a diamond in the rough.
At first, The Man Who Wasn't There seems like a sly, beautifully made pastiche, shot in ravishing black and white by the great Roger Deakins. The Coens really know their Hollywood classics. There are allusions to, among other things, Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt and Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity. But they also know the rhythms of film noir, briskly setting up the pallid Ed as a kind of ghost in his own life, an ordinary man carried along to a destiny he doesn't want. And for one glorious stretch, between the first murder and Ed's master plan for Birdie, the movie promises to be the most resonant work the Coens have ever done. Although the story is set more than 50 years ago, it captures a distinctively contemporary kind of melancholy, an odd, slightly glib passivity that made me think of the Japanese novelist Haruki Murakami. Like a Murakami hero, Ed is a born observer whose occasional bits of enterprise engender events far vaster than any he could anticipate. Yet just when you expect Ed's story to get really exciting and the emotions to deepen, the story gets Coenized. It loses its way in jokes and mere cleverness. The melancholy is devoured by the appearance of a comically vainglorious lawyer played by Tony Shalhoub, who uses Heisenberg's uncertainty principle as a legal defense. And then there's a car crash, which is filmed with such preening self-satisfaction that it crushes what we've been feeling for the characters. This is, of course, one of the Coens' great problems. Just when you want them to carry you into the heart of their story, they start giving you free samples of their brilliance. Absolute control freaks, they're so busy shaping every single image and sound that they lose touch with their deepest emotions and themes. This happens in film after film. But why? I've begun to wonder if the problem isn't that they're a team. They talk through everything so completely that no messy feelings can ever emerge. And messiness is the stuff of film noir. Or could the problem be that they're brothers, caught in some peculiar form of arrested adolescent giggling? Then again, maybe they're just shallow entertainers, leery of real emotion. Which isn't to say that this new film is as bloodless as, say, The Hudsucker Proxy. For Billy Bob Thornton, who here looks a bit like an exhumed Humphrey Bogart, plays Ed with a spectral gravity that keeps hinting at depths the movie itself never plumbs. Thornton is the very incarnation of an ordinary man's feeling of entrapment. And watching his odd blend of boredom, disdain, desire, and sadness, you find yourself feeling things that the Coens' glibness keeps distracting you from. What breathes life into the man who wasn't there is the actor who so emphatically is.
John Powers is executive editor of LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Michael Jackson's hit Billie Jean is just one of hundreds of recordings produced by Quincy Jones. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Quincy Jones about his work with Jackson, Lionel Hampton, Ray Charles, and others. He has a new autobiography and a new CD box set. Join us for the next Fresh Air.